It is with great pleasure that I am introducing our next guest on the Reset Diabesity podcast, Dr. Samer Matar. Dr. Matar is Professor in Chief of the Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery Division at the Baylor College of Medicine. He's the Director of the Metabolic Surgery and Medical Weight Loss Clinic at Baylor St. Luke's Medical Center and the Program Director for the General Surgery Residency Mentorship Program in the Department of General Surgery at Baylor College of Medicine. Prior to that, Dr. Matar was the Medical Director of Weight Loss Services at the Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, and he served as the Chief of Bariatric Services and the Surgical Weight Loss Center at Oregon Health and Sciences University. Dr. Matar is the past President of the American Society of Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery and the President of the Fellowship Council. Dr. Matar, thank you for joining us on the Reset Diabesity podcast today. It's a real pleasure to get the opportunity to discuss metabolic disease and treatments with you.
I've been reading your research. Your research is excellent. I understand it as a layman in your discipline. I understand it to the best of my ability, but it's very good. And it's very, very plainly written in a way that I think communicates your message. This is a great opportunity to have you here, and I really appreciate that very much. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your background, please?
Yes. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me and asking me to participate in this very noble mission of yours, and that is to clarify what it is that we do in the field of metabolic and bariatric medicine. I am a bariatric surgeon, and I've been doing this exclusively for about 20 years now, ever since I finished my specialized training. And as you mentioned, I have worked in several institutions around the country, and I feel like I've gained a lot of experience in managing this very important, vital, multifaceted problem. I've worked with very inspiring people throughout my career who've guided me and who've supported me. And frankly, when people ask me why I do this, I couldn't think of a more rewarding job in the world. I mean, we take patients who are pretty despondent, who have reached extreme levels of frustration, who suffer from the ravages of multiple medical conditions that serve to only deteriorate their quality of life and indeed shorten their life expectancy. And here, as a result of our treatments, we approach these patients in a multidisciplinary fashion. We actually reverse many, if not all, of these medical conditions. We improve their quality of life, and we even make them happier. And if they didn't have medical conditions when they come to us, at least we prevent them from happening through our modalities and therapies. So I think you can tell I love what I do.
I can, yes. It's you have a team practice. You have a holistic team approach to this that is growing in recognition, although not nationally established just yet. It's still happening, where you're integrating this, both the medical and the surgical. You're integrating the psychological, the nutrition, exercise. The program that I went through, the nurse would take us shopping and point out what food groups we should be getting, what food groups we shouldn't be getting, how to eat. It was a home ec class for people who had missed that. It was really good. It was that helped a lot. And the sense of building community around care, I think, translated to the patients as well. Which is, tell me a little bit about how you got here. That I can see the passion around the patients. What did it take to get to a place where you're running your own center that's based on these principles, and you're seeing the changes in people's lives? How did you get to that place?
Well, as I mentioned, I've been in this field for a couple of decades now, and I've always promoted. After discovering the benefits of the multidisciplinary approach, I've always promoted the development and growth of programs that were structured to do that. And here at Baylor College of Medicine, they had all the fundamentals for doing this. And there was an opportunity for me to come and join the faculty here and create the kind of program. There was support for that from the leadership to also allow me to produce this, both to help patients in the in our region, but also to demonstrate it as a model for others to emulate.
That's fantastic. Did you you got your MD in Egypt, is that correct?
Correct.
And then you did your residency, your internship, your residency, your fellowships in the United States.
Correct.
Why the jump over?
Yeah. So after graduating from Cairo University, I did some postgraduate training in the United Kingdom, and I was in Edinburgh, in Scotland, and had a pretty good time, learned a lot there, but I wanted to continue to ascend the leadership ladder, if you will. And they said in order to do that, I had to find some research projects to improve my CV. And there weren't any opportunities available. However, I had asked them if I was able to come to the United States just for the purpose of doing research, would that satisfy the needs? And they said, sure. So I was lucky to get a research position at Emory University in Atlanta. And during those 2 years, I would attend lectures and grand rounds and other educational meetings at the university and integrate with the residents as much as possible. And I liked the level of healthcare here. I found it was more superior than anywhere else I had encountered. So I worked to become a doctor here in the United States. And so I prepared and passed the equivalence examination, the USMLE. Mm. And once I did that, I entered the residency program at the internship level. So basically I had to restart my training again. And then after that, fellowship. So there's a whole decade of my life that I invested in this, but it paid off in the end because I was able to both learn and contribute to this fascinating field.
How did bariatric surgery get to the place it is today? What were the steps that helped get over some of those initial problems?
It was, as I mentioned, the multidisciplinary approach that we have to pay for patients now. That we in the past these patients would receive surgery without adequate, proper, and proper preparation. Plus, if you recall, most of the operations were done open, meaning they would have a big incision extending down their middle of their abdomen. And now, since the late 90s, early 2000s, we've had laparoscopic principles that were adopted. And what laparoscopy does is it reduces pain a lot. And so patients get up out of bed and walk earlier, as you mentioned. And they start drinking earlier as well, regaining their normal habits, and get out of the hospital that much sooner. They spend one or two nights in the hospital instead of five and six. And so the number of complications were markedly reduced as a result of laparoscopy. And this, I think, is what really propelled bariatric surgery into the space it is now. It's the technological advances that we apply, plus the multidisciplinary approach.
I'm interested in how other nations are approaching obesity as a problem. In the United States, it's currently 42-43% of the U.S. population is obese or overweight. Is that right?
Obese.
I'm not sure, but is obese.
Yes.
Okay. The global numbers are equally bad. What does our care look like versus the care elsewhere?
Yeah. So you're right about the numbers, but they're actually even more alarming than what you mentioned. There are predictions from the WHO, the World Health Organization, and from the U.S. CDC and other departments that the incidence of obesity will continue to rise at alarming rates throughout the world, including the United States. So in the United States, we're predicting that by the year 2030, 50% of our population will be obese. And this is not, as you mentioned, an American phenomenon. It affects every single nation in the world, so much that in Africa now there are more people who are overweight than underweight. There are countries like the Gulf area and the Middle East, where in Kuwait, for example, 80% of the females are obese. And there are other staggering numbers in other countries as well. So this is a worldwide phenomenon that is critical and needs to be addressed immediately. What are other countries doing? Well, they're probably recognizing this phenomenon, and they're trying their best to address to their populations on healthy eating habits and more activities. But we know that that often falls short of what is really needed.
And there are, we were talking about the number of comorbidities that occur with obesity, and it's staggering. It's in many ways a death sentence.
Yeah.
I am, as you know, I myself am a bariatric patient, and what drove me to my surgeons, my physicians, was desperation. I thought that that was, I felt out of options and I needed to do something. I don't know if it was courageous. For me, it was just desperate. I just needed to change. We've talked a little bit about that. What does that look like for the patients that come in and see you when they've got a desperation to do something? How does that translate into outcomes?
Thank you. By the way, you look great.
Oh, thank you.
And congratulations on all the hard work you've done to improve your health. The comorbidities is an interesting phenomenon that we see in our patients. I was taught by Harvey Sugarman, who's deceased now. He was one of the giants in the field, and he said, Samer, metabolic syndrome and obesity, they affect, the problems associated with it start at the head and in the toes and affect every organ in between. Meaning that if you look at any body system, any body organ, you'll see it's in one way or another negatively affected by the ravages of this problem. And so the patients who come to us are, for the most part, despondent. They are sadly downtrodden in some ways because they feel that they've repeatedly tried honestly and firmly to lose weight, and it's just a very frustrating disease, such as diabetes as well. And they come to me at a point in their lives where they feel very frustrated, depressed, and just at their wit's end. And they're coming to me for a final solution. And so this helps a lot because they're at a stage now where they are very serious about wanting to improve their health and get better. And as you know, with any of these major operations, there has to be a lot of optimization of the patient and also education. And so for the majority of them, they are very willing to listen, to learn, and improve different areas so that they are geared for success, so to speak. And it helps a lot.
Have you seen any particular combination? And I imagine the variability is so great that, well, I'll just ask. Have you seen any combination of therapeutics that's working more effectively than any other? Is there a formula you're finding, or is it just too idiosyncratic?
Well, we know for certain that bariatric surgery plus the modification of the diet that patients follow, meaning focusing on protein and reducing carbohydrates, and taking vitamins, plus regular activities, whether it's aerobic or muscle strengthening activities in a periodic fashion. This seems to be the ideal formula, so to speak, for maintained and long-term success. When there are special circumstances that can happen, maybe an illness or whatever, a social event that might get the patients off track, and then that results in some weight recurrence, then we apply additional options, such as the anti-obesity medications that we offered, or maybe some additional psychological support. And of course, our nutritionists are always available to get patients back on track again.
I found this to be true, that there's almost a cascading effect at some point, that as my weight increased, no matter what I would do, it would result in some other increase of weight, that it would the net result would be more weight. And the more that just started to happen, the more it kept happening. There was just that sounds inane, but it was as if the symptoms and the illnesses and all these other comorbidities were happening.
Snowball effect.
It was all snowball.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're seeing?
Yes.
With patients? That's
absolutely
happening.
You look back over the years, and if some of them come with a long graph of their annual weight gain, and you'll see a clear ascendance, a clear rise in their weight gain year after year, then of course the medical conditions start developing.
What is the percentage between the people who need intervention in some form or fashion and those who get referred to you, and then those who actually make it to surgery? The attrition rate seems very high to me. Certainly in the class I went through, there was a cadre. So they would do these in classes, and the surgeries would be staggered. And each of these cadres, we would get together and for the preoperative, and we would weigh in, we'd go through the diets, do all that stuff. Of that group, I would say maybe 30% actually had the surgery. There was probably 70% attrition between the starting group and that group. I don't know how many were weeded out by insurance, by the process, by depression, by just a sense of hopelessness. What's going on there?
Yeah, you bring up a very good point, because it's a little disappointing, sad actually, that we have these resources and we have proven therapies, celebrated ones, yet we're only, as a nation, we're only really treating 1 to 2% of the eligible population. Now, there are many reasons for this very large gap in between who deserves therapy and who actually receives it. And there are many stakeholders involved. But it is true that once patients do arrive at our programs as new patients, as I mentioned, the key to success is adequate preparation of the patient. And this can take 3 months on average. And we do see an attrition rate. You mentioned 30%. In our program, it's about 50%. And we try to minimize that as much as possible by keeping a very close eye on our patients as they advance through the pipeline, so to speak, to get to surgery. Because the preparation process requires consultations with other specialists. If they have sleep apnea, they need a sleep study, labs, you know. And this all works for the benefit of the patient, but some patients just either get frustrated or they realize that their insurance has changed and they no longer have coverage, which is a whole different topic that I'd like to talk about, and how there still is a lot of bias and discrimination against our patients. So for a variety of reasons, we do see attrition along the pipeline, which is very sad and frustrating.
Imagine so. Now, I'm familiar with my A1C from being diabetic, from having pre-diabetes and diabetes. The A1C also was a little bit misleading. It wasn't the most refined metric, in the same way that BMI is not the most refined metric. I mean, there are still some variances. There's something, if if I want to get a patient, I have a patient that presents, has issues, is there, am I looking for something like BMI, or am I looking for something like the A1C? What's a trigger to call you?
It's all these things. Okay. Obviously, the BMI is the main criterion, so to speak. But if the patient has additional problems associated with the high BMI, such as you mentioned diabetes or even prediabetes, hypertension, sleep apnea, all these things, these are all indications for referring. But even if a patient has a BMI and no perceptible or recognized medical conditions, refer them, because usually we'll find something else that has been not overlooked necessarily, but that we can distinguish. I think the A1C can be misleading because remember that the A1C is a snapshot of what happened 3 months ago. So it doesn't necessarily give you an idea of what the current state is. But we do use it as one of the criteria to look into. And especially as we start working with the patient, we track the A1C every few months to just see if our actions are having any beneficial effect on the A1C.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, certainly on the economic side and on the public health side, that if half of America is obese, this is worse than an epidemic. We've reached a place that's almost unsustainable. What do we do? I have to ask: Is it just calorie-rich, empty foods that's driving this in part? Is it? What are the variables that are generating this much growth in obesity?
So, as we mentioned at the top of our conversation today, this is a multifaceted problem. It's obviously a medical one, but it's also a social one, a political one, a cultural one. So in order to effectively address this, you have to really touch on all of these areas. You have to provide healthy food and eliminate the food deserts that are out there. And this takes, this is going to take a national movement. It has to be supported by the federal government. It's one of these national programs that have to be launched. And then, of course, there's a lot of patient education that has to take place. Right now, all our events, especially holiday ones, are associated with food. If you think about it, patients, weddings, funerals, Christmas, Thanksgiving, they're all associated with food. And that can be fine, but let's try and improve on the quality of the food that is presented. Same thing goes for patients' attitude towards food on a more cultural level. You know, our way of showing appreciation or celebrating is to do it with food, and perhaps there are healthier ways of showing love and respect and celebrating accomplishments. But by and large, I mean, the main problem is the long-term consequences of this epidemic on our nation as a whole, and this has to be addressed. I think it's going to have to be addressed in a movement of giant proportions to make significant change in what is happening right now.
There's an issue here where intervention can make a difference. We need to find the right scale of intervention. Am I mischaracterizing that?
No, I think you're head up. You're quite right.
And I our hope here is that we want to raise national awareness. We also want to have local impact.
Yes.
And it's the local impact that makes a difference in changing. In changing the ordinary, changing the everyday, changing the routine. It has to happen where you are, not just from on high. How How do we go about doing that? How do we go about engaging our local population?
I think it starts with easy victories. I think it starts with schools trying to go back to more opportunities for physical activities, more scrutiny on what kind of foods are offered to children in cafeterias and vending machines. I think it also goes into then teaching the parents and raising awareness among them about proper cooking habits and food purchases. So small, and then move on to other sectors gradually. A friend of mine mentioned he just came visited us in Texas here from New England, and he was mentioning at how spacious the state is and how there are the distances between districts is so wide that you needed to have a car to go anywhere. Whereas in the Northeast, you can do a lot of your daily activities by just walking. And so this is another problem that we have, is that there aren't many opportunities to exercise and be active, and we have to promote that. And finally, look at what is in our daily foods that we eat on a regular basis, and the introduction of preservatives and high fructose corn syrup, and how that can affect our metabolism. So as you can see, it's not just a medical issue. It's a social, cultural, professional, civic problem that has to be addressed at a very high level. And it requires a nationwide movement.
You have a team practice. You have a holistic team approach to this that is growing in recognition, although not nationally established just yet. It's still happening, where you're integrating both the medical and the surgical. You're integrating the psychological, the nutrition, exercise. The program that I went through, the nurse would take us shopping and point out what food groups we should be getting, what food groups we shouldn't be getting, how to eat. It was a home ec class for people who had missed that. It was really good. It was that helped a lot. And the sense of building community around care, I think, translated to the patients as well. How did you arrive at that approach to care?
Well, we've realized from our experience that metabolic syndrome and morbid obesity, they're multifaceted and very complex disease processes that really affect every sphere in life, everyone. And not only the patients, but their family members as well. And they affect patients both physiologically and psychologically, and affect them in many areas. So we felt that if we were to just provide one isolated area in the treatment process, that the patients ultimately might not do as well unless we really addressed every component of this disease. And this is why we now have adopted this multidisciplinary approach, which is adopted also by other successful programs, in that we realize that patients have to be managed in every one of these disciplines, meaning we have to address their psychological components of the disease. We have to address, obviously, the medical ones, evaluate and optimize them. We have to address the physical issues that they might have in terms of limitation of movements and activities. We have to address their socioeconomic status and see what their home situation is like, what their work situation is like, so that everything is aligned and optimized for success. And this takes a small army of people.
I imagine. Well, I know the practices that I've looked at so far, the ones that seem to have the most success are those that have a holistic approach, those that understand a team is necessary for this, to solve this problem.
Exactly. If I might elaborate on that a little bit, we over the last few years, we've tended to approach this problem just like other programs approach patients who have cancer. As you know, cancer can be treated obviously with surgery, but also with chemotherapy and radiation, radiotherapy. And you need an oncologic group of people who are geared to contribute to the patient's success in their own area of expertise. Same thing happens with transplant patients. And we found it by adopting this approach that we get much better results in terms of long-term efficacy, long-term improvement and effects of patients. And this is why we often combine surgery with the new medications that are out there, with the prehabilitation and post-habilitation as well of patients.
The notion of what brings a patient to you. How does a patient get to you, and what do the steps look like?
The majority of patients who come to me have been contemplating coming to me for about 1 or 2, sometimes longer, years. And the reason for this is that they've been obviously researching, gathering information, listening to friends, relatives, or people who might have had our treatments and trying to make a decision, which is a very brave and courageous one if you think about it. It's easy for a patient who has gallstones or who has a painful appendix, inflamed appendix, to come to the doctor, sure. But these are patients who are essentially not in pain anywhere in their abdomen, they are exposing themselves, they're subjecting themselves to major surgery for the prime and only purpose of improving their health. And so I really admire these patients, and I tell them that don't listen to people who tell you you've come to me as the easy way out. You're actually, you should be congratulated for taking a very serious decision and for weighing all the facts. And then we go into a detailed conversation about the risks and benefits and the different options that we have, the portfolio of options that we can offer patients. But yeah, this is how they come to me, usually after many, many years of having been told to just move more and eat less, with hardly anything to show for it except for persistent gain of weight year after year.
I've read, in fact, I read a paper that you've written about preoperative weight loss. And that process was, I found that process pretty daunting. And myself, it was a moment of panic. When I thought, oh dear, you know, I've got to really change everything. Where are you at with preoperative diet, preoperative weight loss?
There are two main benefits of short-term preoperative weight loss. I mean, when we ask patients to lose a little bit of weight before surgery, this is not just another attempt to lose weight as instituted by other physicians or providers. When we ask patients to lose some weight before surgery, it's both to get them on track in preparation for surgery, because a lot of the times this will be the diet that they will follow after surgery. But more important also, it improves the conduct of the operation itself. Many people don't realize that when we gain weight and we deposit fat in our bodies, it's not just fat deposited under the skin, but it also gets deposited inside the abdomen. It increases the fat content of our body internally. And also it gets deposited within organs themselves. And the liver is a very prime example of this, that as we gain weight, fat gets deposited in the liver. The liver enlarges in size. And the liver covers the stomach like a blanket, which we have to lift out of the way in order to gain access to the stomach if we're going to operate on that. And sometimes if it's too large, it becomes unyieldy and doesn't allow adequate surgery to happen. And it can increase the risk of complications or difficulty in completing the operation safely. And that's why we found that for those patients who are above a certain BMI, it's sometimes beneficial to have them lose weight. Now, the preponderance of the science has shown that some papers have shown benefits from weight loss and others have not. So the jury is still out on that. However, what bothers us is that some stakeholders, and I'm talking about insurance payers here, they actually take advantage, so to speak, of the so-called benefits of preoperative weight loss and use that as a barrier to access. And they'll say, you have to lose a certain amount of weight before surgery. And that is no longer a medical step towards optimizing the patient, but rather now a physical barrier. And we oppose that, of course.
Have you found that the introduction of Ozempic and other drugs like that has been a benefit to getting people ready? Do you use it as a tool on the way to surgery? I imagine some patients, a medical approach is a valid option and works and helps them get to where they need to be for health reasons. I also imagine that for surgery, it could be the preoperative weight loss process, or could contribute to that. Is that a misperception?
No, you've struck it right on. We are very excited about the advent and the adoption of anti-obesity medications, Ozempic being one of them, and Mounjaro and Wegovy and others. Plus, I believe there are about another 80 such medications in the pipeline. So they're here to stay, I think, and that's a good thing. We welcome these medications, and in fact, we do use them. We integrate them into our options. As I mentioned, we work with obesity medicine experts who help patients lose weight through these medications, and we occasionally prescribe them ourselves, either in the preoperative phase to help with the weight loss that when it is necessary, especially in the bigger patients who propose a surgical risk. And we help them sometimes, we use them sometimes to help patients who might be struggling with some weight recurrence after surgery. And that's where they come into play as well. But by and large, we have embraced anti-obesity medications wholeheartedly, and we use them as one of the options that we have, just like you would embrace a new therapeutic medication for patients with cancer.
And that becomes part of an integrated or holistic approach to patient care. This is another tool in the toolbox.
Exactly. Powerful tool.
And it seems, now we don't, do we know the long-term effects of these?
No, and that is obviously the devil in the details, so to speak. We don't have any long-term data on these medications, and they do have side effects. They do result in significant weight loss, but only as long as you take them. So if you were to stop taking these medications for any reason, the weight would rebound and perhaps even more than before. Which, by the way, makes bariatric surgery look like a bargain compared to the high cost of these drugs. And so they have their place, but we still don't know what the long-term consequences of using them are.
I know when I my metabolic journey, for lack of a better term, started, it was I found myself pre-diabetic, and that was sort of the first red flag for me. Although I don't think I thought of it as a red flag then. They prescribed metformin, and I probably lost 15 pounds. But for somebody who's eventually 360 pounds, 15 pounds isn't enough to change my wellness. It isn't enough to affect my health per se. In those instances, the only real cure for obesity and diabetes and diabetes that I have seen, and for me, sleep apnea and a host of other problems, was surgery. Are there other viable long-term possibilities out there?
As effective, as durable, and as safe as surgery? No. Okay. Bariatric surgery to this day remains the most effective and the most durable single option for patients, provided it is delivered in a multidisciplinary approach that continues to monitor and track patients after surgery for the long term. Like in our program and many other programs, we never discharge a patient. We continue lifelong support.
And when we moved back to Houston, you were recommended by everybody. And so we wanted a local bariatric specialist who understood, for my wife and I, understood what we had been doing, or what our surgery was about and why. And so we came to see you. It's a relief to see that the UNC still is sending me things every week, at least, checking in, how are you doing? There, we've got a new webinar. There's a new class coming up. Do you want to, you know, any of these sort of things, do you want to opt into? That kind of support goes a long way. And that's the kind of support that your practice gives to patients. Where do you find them reaching out to you? Are you guys reaching out to them? How does that dynamic work?
Yes. So every patient who we encounter through their electronic medical record gets something. I think it's called, the proprietary name is MyChart or something like that, which allows them access confidentially in a secure manner to our program. And through that link, if you will, we will repeatedly send messages of support groups that are coming up or any social events that might be coming up. And then we also stay in touch with the patient if they don't show up for a follow-up meeting or an encounter to make sure that they're still in the family, if you will, in the community of patients that we have. That is mainly how we do. We also have email addresses, and sometimes we'll send out blast emails, so to speak, to just inform them of an event that's coming up. But as I mentioned, we never discharge patients, and we continue to offer post-op follow-ups, and that's mainly how we maintain connection with the patients. We feel it's very important that we maintain this relationship. Patients tend to do better.
Let's talk a little bit about, if you don't mind, a little bit about the surgery part of it. Mm-hmm. Are you finding one procedure to be particularly effective? What are the trade-offs? I had a SADI, which was in 2021. I had a SADI, so fairly early in the process, but certainly not first in. My wife had a duodenal switch, although. There are some differences we've noticed in diet and in how we process food. What are you seeing in terms of procedures and outcomes? Mm-hmm. Is what I'm trying to say.
So, in terms of the available surgical options, there are at least four that are the more common ones. You might have heard of the sleeve gastrectomy. Mm-hmm. And this is an operation that is very simple in concept, that it involves resecting or removing about 70 to 80% of the stomach and leaving behind a slim sleeve, if you will, of the stomach. And this appears to be the more gentle, better tolerated operation for patients. And it delivers reasonable results, very good results. Its main drawback there is that in some patients it can make acid reflux work worse. And in terms of weight loss, it's probably about 10, maybe 15% less than the other operations that I would mention. But it does have a very good effect on medical conditions. The gastric bypass is an operation that has been around for about 50, 60, 70 years, ever since Ed Mason created it in the University of Iowa. And this is a more complex operation, which involves creating a small pouch out of the stomach and connecting it to intestine in more than one area, two connections. And it's very good for patients who have acid reflux. It's the ideal anti-reflux operation, and it delivers very good results. It has a solid track record, and many patients do well with it. You have to be aware, though, that because we manipulate small intestine, there's always a chance of scarring down there or hernias that can cause small bowel obstruction. The SADI, which you had, is actually the single anastomosis duodeno ileostomy. And in this operation, it combines a sleeve gastrectomy, like I mentioned, and it also brings up intestine and connects it. Instead of connecting it to the top of the stomach, like in the gastric bypass, it connects it to the first part of the duodenum, which is the beginning of the small intestine. And so it connects it to a loop that will bring up from the bottom end of the intestine. And it allows for a reasonable length of small intestine downstream to allow adequate absorption of nutrients. The duodenal switch that your wife had is a more powerful operation because typically the amount of absorptive surface of the small intestine is shorter than with the Sadie. And that's why that operation is more powerful and a little more aggressive in terms of weight loss, but it also, you know, Spider-Man taught us that with great power comes great responsibility. And so if the patient doesn't keep up diligently with their nutritional needs, they can fall behind easily. And so this operation can result in tremendous weight loss, tremendous improvement of comorbidities, but at a higher risk of nutritional deficiencies. The Sadie is a more gentler modification of that operation. And then we have the bypass, as I mentioned, and the sleeve gastrectomy.
I'm wondering if those patients who come to you who may need this therapy, deserve this therapy, they may not meet the criteria. What happens to those patients? What is the criteria and what happens to those patients?
So the criteria have changed over the last few years. Our society, the ASMBS, and the International Society of Obesity, we've agreed on new guidelines based on all the evidence that's been published. And the new guidelines or new criteria, so to speak, are dropping the BMI from 40 to 35. By the way, BMI is body mass index. And this is for all comers. And for those patients who have actual medical conditions that are currently present, their BMI is dropping from 35 to 30. So to speak, we've expanded the pool of patients, so to speak. But there are still patients who don't qualify. Obviously, if they don't meet the BMI, if they're less than 30, they're not considered surgical candidates. There are patients also who don't qualify if they are currently under severe socioeconomic or psychological issues that need to be resolved before we add more stress to them with surgery. And the others who don't qualify are those who are currently abusing substances, whether it's alcohol or illegal substances. We ask for a certain amount of abstinence from these substances before they're considered candidates. Otherwise, patients who qualify are entered into the program and they start the evaluation process.
There's a bit of a controversy, for lack of a better term, around BMI in general and what BMI really means to an individual or versus a general population. Could you explain that a little bit, please?
Yeah. So the BMI, or body mass index, was created by a Frenchman, I think about a few hundred years ago, and it was mostly for recruitment of military personnel in France. And it was one of the parameters that they were using to admit young men into the armed forces there. And what the BMI does is it takes into account a patient's height and a patient's weight. And as it doesn't distinguish what the different body compartments are. It doesn't distinguish whether this patient's or person's weight is from muscle mass or fat or fluid. And this is why the common example that is given is that of a quarterback football player. He will have a high BMI But it's mostly muscle mass, and that doesn't necessarily mean that he or she, this person, might have metabolic syndrome. So we're coming up with better ways of scoring the patient's risk for metabolic syndrome, bringing into account the amount of adipose tissue in the body, and also incorporating the different medical conditions that might be available, and that might give us a more accurate and realistic evaluation of a patient's risk. But we haven't gotten there yet. So, for lack of a better term, BMI is what we use right now to distinguish who are candidates for surgery. And it's also the parameter that is used by insurance companies and payers and other stakeholders. So it's convention more than anything.
I know that, mine varied wildly. When I was, after suffering an injury, I had gone up to 260, and that was, I was around 37. My BMI was at 37. At its height, that was at 52. These days, it's down, it's 25. I know that, the numbers didn't mean a lot to me until they were broken out into classes, class 1, 2, and 3. And could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So there are three classes of obesity. Class 1 is 30 to 35 BMI, and class 2 is 35 to 40, and class 3 is above 40, which is severe obesity. And that's when the higher the class, the more likelihood there will be of life-threatening medical conditions.
Do you see your patients falling in one of those classes as a rule, or is it all over the place?
The preponderance of my patients are class 3 and above.
And that's the state, at least for me, that's the state where getting resolution was I became desperate to resolve the problem for me personally. And do you find your patients generally are in that frame of mind?
Correct, yes. Okay. They are.
I don't know if your practice, how your practice differs in this way, but how much contact do the patients have with you? I know that in my experience before, my contact with the surgeon was limited to just one introduction in the surgery. With the medical team, with the entire care team, it was very regular, very constant. What does your model look like?
So our model is that we have the initial encounter, which is the new patient visit when patients come in. And usually before they arrive at our doorstep, they will have watched an educational seminar, which is available online. And then I see them and get a medical history and explain about the program and what we're going to do. Then they enter into the evaluation process. And I see them again at what we call the review visit, where we gather all the information, everything that's happened since the initial interview. And this is usually at about 3 months after the first meeting. And we talk more about the specific surgery that they will be receiving, both according to that patient's preference or the most appropriate for their medical conditions. And then the next visit is what we call the pre-op visit, which is that operation, that meeting that we have in, it's the last meeting before the surgery where we discuss in detail how the day is going to go. When they're getting the surgery, we sign the informed consent, and we explain how the hospital stay will happen and what to do before and after surgery. So I see them at least 3 times.
Okay.
And, of course, they see my my staff, my nurse practitioner, and my dietitians and other personnel much more frequently, and they attend both individual visits by these people and class visits as well.
That's great.
Yeah, and if you were to meet any of the nurses in the hospital, it's nice to hear them say that our patients tend to be the most informed, and they're the ones who are always asking the nurse to help them get out of bed so they can walk and drink and so on. So it's nice to know that we're doing a good job in preparing these patients.
There was an active they were very excited about getting me out of bed as soon as humanly possible. I do recall that. That seems to be a trend, is getting up and moving after surgery.
So I did mention that bariatric surgery has become very safe. Mm-hmm. But there is a mortality rate still. It's not zero. It's 1 point. It's 0 point. It's 0.01, which means about 1 in 1,000. And the most common cause of this very low incidence of death is still pulmonary embolism, or DVTs and pulmonary embolism. And so we work very hard at preventing that, protecting patients from DVTs by giving them anticoagulants, those SCD machines that massage the legs, and getting them out of bed as soon as possible, which is usually about 4 hours after surgery, as soon as they're safe enough to stand up on their own.
That's a pretty remarkable timeline. Mm-hmm. Get somebody moving around post-surgery.
That's the beauty of our minimally invasive therapies, whether it's laparoscopic or robotic. Yeah.
Do you find yourself using the robot?
I'm beginning to use to show some interest in it. I still feel that I'm more facile and more comfortable doing the operation laparoscopically. It's what I've been accustomed to doing for 20 years. But one of the nice things about the robot is that you can operate sitting down. And so it's as you grow older, you start developing these backaches. And so the robot, as I see it, it becomes a little more appealing every year.
Is this the Da Vinci system?
It is.
For reasons of transparency, about 100 years ago, I worked for DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and was working on building the telemedicine, telesurgical suite, which eventually became Da Vinci. And my task was to look at how surgeons physically were interacting with space to help create the interface. The original concept was for battlefield surgery, that you would have a surgeon who could be in the United States performing an operation in theater through a robot and increase the amount of throughput without increasing the amount of physicians getting shot at while they're trying to perform surgery. In that last 20 years, it's become its own thing now. It's pretty impressive how far that's gone.
Yeah, the technology is amazing, especially for remote surgeries, like you mentioned. I think both Dr. Gagnier and Dr. Talamini worked on this, especially Dr. Talamini with the Navy, on how to be able to offer surgical services on a boat, on one of the marine battleships, while a surgeon is actually stateside, if not monitoring, actually moving the equipment into the patient. So, yeah, that opens up a lot of very exciting developments.
I'll date myself. It was Rick Satava who was the program manager quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
Are you still practicing Nissen's outside of bariatric practice, outside of bariatric surgery?
Yes, I occasionally do what we call foregut surgery, which is benign diseases of the esophagus and the stomach, such as acid reflux.
I had a hiatal hernia. This is not for broadcast necessarily. I had a hiatal hernia fixed at GW a very long time ago, and they redid it all during the surgery. I imagine that's pretty normal if somebody comes in with a pre-existing.
Yeah, again, one of the problems with having a high BMI is that it can cause prior hiatus hernia repairs to break down from the pressure. Yeah. and other issues. So we tend to see that a lot in our patients, and we now almost routinely look at the area, and if we find that it is a significant hiatus hernia there, we fix it in the course of the operation.
Curiously, after the Nissen, I couldn't throw up for years. I would eat something bad, and I was just stuck.
Yeah.
After the bariatric procedure, I discovered I could throw up again. So I'm not sure what transpired, but...
Well, they had to take down the wrap that's associated with the Nissen fundoplication. As you know, they wrap the lower part of the esophagus with the top of the stomach to do a Nissen. And that is what prevents post-operative patients from throwing up. They can't vomit anymore. And in fact, it can become a dangerous situation called gas bloat syndrome. And this is why we advise patients not to drink any carbonated beverages after Nissen fundoplications, because they can't burp even sometimes. Mm-hmm. Now, in the course of subsequent surgeries, such as a sleeve gastrectomy, in order to do a proper sleeve, you have to take down that wrap at the top of the stomach and return the stomach to its normal anatomy. That's why patients are able to vomit once again.
That's very interesting. There was another article of yours I read. It was about closures and incisions, and it was staples, and it was very interesting. The takeaway for me was that as long as it was performed properly, there wasn't a material difference, statistically significant difference between one method of closure and another method of closure.
You're talking about how we connected the what we call the anastomosis.
Yes.
How we made the anastomosis, and there are a variety of ways of doing this, whether it's using mechanical staplers or hand sewing. And you're right; we showed that there was very little difference in between the two.
Have you seen a difference in terms of other morbidity or mortality events, and any of those kind of process issues? It's not a good way to describe it, but any of those mechanical pieces where the surgeon is actually working on the patient and the patient is some environmental issues, whatever there is, but are you seeing differences in outcomes at all?
Not necessarily. We're seeing differences in outcomes in terms of how well prepared the patients were. As I mentioned, if they're extremely heavy, like 500, 600, 700 pounds, then a little bit of weight loss before surgery usually helps the conduct of the operation and have less complications. We've also seen improvement in the materials that we use and the equipment that we use. The stapling has become very reliable. But by and large, no, it more depends on how well we prepared the patients before surgery.
Well, that's very interesting. I was fortunate enough to run the Lessons Learned program for CIA. Mm. I ran that and then the one for OD&I. And it was the ability to perform a morbidity and mortality meeting, so to speak, in that environment where it was really about learning and getting better at the job than it was anything else. And I've seen that in medicine. In fact, the model was a model adopted from both medicine and from after-action reviews that the military does. How integrated is that process in your practice?
Yeah, it's fully integrated, 100%. We have regular, we call them M&M meetings, mm-hmm. Morbidity and mortality meetings, or adverse event meetings, and we discuss every single occurrence that might happen, whether it's a patient who had some nausea or had to come back to the emergency room because they were dehydrated, or a patient who might have had a wound infection or anything like that. We discuss this as a group and learn from that so that we can apply whatever we learn into the next patient and try and prevent this.
Thank you for listening to part one of our interview with Dr. Samer Matar. In part one, we had a chance to get to know Dr. Matar. We discussed the state of the U.S. and global obesity epidemic and a variety of treatments available for managing metabolic disease. In part two, we will get Dr. Matar's thoughts on ongoing obesity patient issues, sociocultural issues, economic and environmental issues, and ideas to help primary care providers refer and manage obese patients. Thank you for spending your time tuning into this episode of Reset Diabesity. I hope that you found it to be of use in your continuing diabetes education. We'd like to thank Medtronic for the unrestricted educational grant and to encourage you to visit our website or the show notes wherever you get your podcasts for more information. Please feel free to send us questions, comments, or show ideas you may have for future Reset Diabesity episodes. I'm your host, Dr. Rob Johnston, and thank you again for listening. The content of this podcast includes opinions of the participants and are not to be construed as medical advice. Always consult your own physician for medical guidance.